Welcome, thanks for tuning in. You're about to listen to a conversation between author Amanda Hampson and Bad Sydney Crime Writers Festival Artistic Director Catherine de Plumonage. In this relaxed chat, Amanda and Catherine discuss The Cryptic Clue, the latest book in a Tea Lady mystery series by Amanda. This recording was made in the Henry Carmichael Theatre in front of a live audience at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts, which is located on Gadigal land.
Thank you very much, and welcome everybody, because I come here quite a lot. I do recognise a few familiar faces, which is always nice. This is going to be a real treat. We've already been talking our heads off, but we've got plenty more to say. And if you haven't booked for the walk after a bit later today, I think there are some QR code sheets on your chairs. It is fabulous to actually see the places, if not the exact places, but the inspiration and the feel of the place. So Elliot is a historian and has done some walks before, he's in Corlette, and so he'll be taking us around. First of all, can you all hear me? Distortion, it's all okay, great. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me and organising up this.
Not at all. So Amanda's written many books, but two Tea Ladies books. When I was told by the publisher last year there was a book called The Tea Ladies, I thought, really? A crime book? Okay, we'll give this one a go. And I think I read three chapters and I just said, yes. And the second one does not disappoint in any way. So first of all, because, you know, we're not 20 here on the whole, who remembers Tea Ladies in their workplace? Yes, I hope
wow.
So. Anybody who actually was a tea lady? That would be unhope, yeah, okay. So, if I've been wondering about, do you remember tea ladies, Amanda? Did you ever have any in any workplace?
Yeah, but I actually, my dad's from Liverpool in England, and in my 20s I went and lived there and actually worked in a garment factory, and we had tea ladies there.
Oh, yeah.
But it wasn't, look, I just wish I had more jobs in my life, because when you're a writer, you just do not know when something is going to become useful. And in fact, if any of you have read The Tea Ladies, I worked in the office processing the garment orders, and we were called the Queen Bees.
The Queen Bees, yes. Yes, wow. So I was trying to remember, and the only thing I can remember is in a building where I worked, a publisher in England, there was a tea trolley. So I think at 11 o'clock, maybe at 3 o'clock, somebody would wheel a tea trolley up and leave it there, and you could go and get it. And then they replaced it with a machine.
Yeah.
And no biscuits, because there were biscuits on the tea trolley, but anyway.
Or the end of biscuits.
Yeah, not entirely bad. I'm becoming slightly obsessed with Tea Ladies, so I was doing a bit of doodling and found this wonderful ad, Johns and Waywood Limited of South Melbourne, advertised for Tea Lady in the Argus in October 1948. They offered £3, 1 shilling and 3 pence for a 5-day a week with hours of work from 11 a.m. to 4:45 p.m. and this is 1948.
Wow.
It's not, you know. I was trying to work out what that is in today's money, but I kind of failed. Really. Yeah, it became too difficult.
And in fact, in The Cryptic Clue, of course, it's 1966, and we know what happened in 1966. And Irene is up to a dodgy deal and gets completely discombobulated in her conversion. Do you remember how difficult that was back then?
Yeah. Yes, well that, yes, anyway, but it works out all right. Anyway, I won't give anything away. Now, your previous books, Amanda, weren't crime. You started with non-fiction and then kind of, let's call it general fiction.
Yeah.
So tell us how you grew from fact to fiction and a bit about your earlier books as well. I've only read one of them.
Okay. I always wanted to write a novel. I grew up on a farm in a place called Pukitaha. In rural New Zealand, and we didn't have TV, and we used to read. So we used to go to the library and get our books, and so I read all the Heidi and Anne of Green Gables and Little Women. So that was something that I really wanted to do. But as I got older, into my 40s, the more I read, and I read very, very widely, the more nervous I got about the whole prospect. So I then had an idea for a non-fiction book, and so I wrote that and sent it to a publisher, and they rang me straight away and said they'd like to publish it. And in fact, I said, oh, great. And she's, you know what I mean? And she said, oh, it's very unusual, you know. I said, yes, I know, but I'm not one that starts screaming. So that came out, and then I wrote another book. I think it was all just building muscle. And then I said, okay, I've got an idea, and I wrote The Olive Sisters. And so I was 50 when that was published. And it was just a massive success right off the bat. So that was fantastic. Then I wrote a book that was the opposite of a massive success. Then I wrote a book that was quite successful, and then one less successful.
So it's and Russian.
Yeah, it is, because I just find an idea that I think, yeah, I can see a story here. And all my books are written, you know, I try to write as well as I possibly can to be evocative, to have strong characters, but I always have humour. And that makes people nervous. Some readers go, oh, this can't possibly be a serious book because there's funny things happen in it. So I think when I just had the idea, so my book before The Tea Ladies was called Lovebirds. It got the best reviews I've ever had. It got the best Goodreads rating, but it came out between two lockdowns. So it just absolutely just didn't go to the ground, which was very disappointing, but many worse things happened to people during COVID.
Oh, so we can discover it now. We can discover it now.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, when COVID started, I said, look, I'm just going to be happy if I'm alive at the end of it, and I am. So then I thought, okay, I'm just going to do something different. And I saw this Facebook page called Australia Remember When. And there was a picture of the tea lady with her trolley and a big double-handed teapot. And there were hundreds of comments of people very, very affectionately remembering tea ladies and what they brought to the office. And somebody wrote, rather mysteriously, the tea lady knew where the bodies were buried. And it was a light bulb moment, because I have always been very, very interested in social history. I loved history and English at school, was useless at everything else. And I loved to know what people were doing at the time. I was a teenager in the 60s, so that attracted me to that period. And I could just feel it fall into place right there and then. And I worked in the garment factory, so I thought, okay, we've got Surrey Hills, just as it is now. The crime thing, okay, that's a bit harder, but I've had a fair bit of practice. And suddenly it came together. And
so it wasn't that you thought, I want to write crime.
No.
It was the idea of these tea ladies who knew where the bodies were buried.
And, you know, I could see straight away that the tea lady was the perfect amateur sleuth, because overlooked and underestimated. Mm. Who here remembers Columbo back in the day? Yes. Now, he's a character I absolutely loved. Do you know how he would go in and he would seem a bit thick, and then he'd have that Macintosh on, and then he'd go, there's something I can't quite understand. Didn't he? He did some weird thing like that. And I love that he would then just come up with something so perfect that would, you know, pull it all together. So I thought, okay, we've got these tea ladies at a time where we have a lot of stratering in businesses, still a lot of social stigma. Factory girls stay down here, the management's upstairs, and in between these different stratas, and never the twain shall meet. But the tea lady would have a diplomatic immunity to move through the building, she'd know everything that's happening. Somebody on that Facebook page said the tea lady could tell you who was getting a pink slip. And you have to be a certain age to know what a pink slip is, but it means you're going to get sacked. So it just has so many components. So I just went straight away and went, okay, this could be just a fantastic crime genre with my current skills of characters. Humour is perfect for it. I don't like gore. I don't like, I love watching crime on television, but, you know, not explicit crime.
So more the Midsummer Murders end.
The Gentleman, Guy Ritchie. I love Guy Ritchie, yes. Just my favourite person. But he doesn't actually show people being, you know,
cut up.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I don't like the cut up. You know, Netflix, they now have gore, extreme violence.
Why would people, why would you watch that? But I mean, the underestimated, No, Agatha Christie, Miss Marple is constantly underestimated. Mm. I mean, she's only the little old lady in the corner with the knitting.
Well, we all are. It just goes with territory. I mean, here we are. Older women are the most capable people on the planet. Anybody disagree with that?
No.
Yeah. And so we're completely underestimated.
I think that's very true. So give us the setup to the series as a whole. You've talked about it, because we are talking a series here. So for anybody like me who reads one book and thinks more,
there are two,
and there is more.
More coming, yes. I just handed in the manuscript for the next one, because there's obviously a long overlap. So The Cryptic Clue, I handed in that manuscript a year ago, and then we have a year of editing and marketing, cover and blah, 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 and then it comes out. So I handed in the next one, which is called The Deadly Dispute, this week, and then I will start on the next one. So there's a lag, but...
Yeah. Like the titles, by the way.
Yeah, it's got a voice of that,
right? Good. So, by the way, who's read The Tea Lady?
Oh, right, okay.
Good. Well, so you don't need much of a setup. For those who haven't, give us a quick setup of the whole universe.
Yes, four tea ladies, and they're all very different. There's Hazel, who is the sort of calm, organised. She's gentle but strong, you know, and not really discombobulated by anything, including being locked in the basement of the building by the Russian mafia.
But also, she has a sexy side. I mean, I may be getting obsessed with this, but I just thought that was incredibly positive. You don't go into it, but she does have relationships with men.
Yes, it's not explicit.
It's not explicit. No,
she's in the Cryptic Clue, she starts dating someone, and yes, she does invite him upstairs. So that's Hazel, and she's always the calming influence on the group. So I guess when I was creating these characters, I was thinking, you know, conflict is what story's about. If you don't have conflict in a story, it's just boring. And conflict in life, not so good, but in a fiction, very good. And so I thought I need them to sort of rub off each other. So then Betty is her best friend, and Betty just adores Hazel and absolutely dotes on her. So Betty is the more sort of dizzy one of the group, but has a very warm heart, and often stumbles on the critical clue. And then Irene comes from a criminal background. Her husband was a famous safe cracker, whose nickname was, he was Fred Tweezers Turnbuckle. And so Irene has, you know, keeps a lot of weapons like knuckle dusters under a bed, and is always wanting to blackmail people or so she lives a sort of secret life that is related, well, it's really not that secret, to more the criminal side. And then there's Merle Perlman. I just want to note how much time I spent on these names. Hazel Bates.
I had a whole question.
Hazel Bates is a lovely, calm, quiet name. And Betty Juicenet, a little bit spicier. And
also sort of like biscuits as well.
Yeah,
biscuits,
that's right.
Biscuits in the time.
And it's got Jew, which is lovely. Jew. Yeah, poetic. And Irene Turnbuckle. I don't know why, that just has a kind of a crunchy feel to me. And then Merle Perlman, to me, has quite a sort of superior feel. Am I mad? No? And so Merle is the best educated of them all, because we're talking 1965 for the first one. They go each year. And a lot of women then, and men, were not very literate, not very well educated. I mean, my dad left school at 12 during the war. So he was highly intelligent, but, you know, he just had to drop out of school. But Merle was a school teacher, so she considers herself a little bit... She's the know-it-all. You know, she's that know-it-all friend that you just have to bite your tongue sometimes because they're just that annoying. So when I get them in a group, I really, particularly now after, you know, writing two books and a manuscript, I know I can just give them the reins, you know, because Irene loves winding people up, particularly Merle, and Hazel calms things down, and Betty gets indignant about things, and Irene's always, she's one of those people, has a cigarette hanging off her lip. and always wears. I don't know if you remember, when I was a kid, there were women who used to just wear their house slippers everywhere. You know, nice comfy house slippers. Well, that's Irene. But she does have a bit of a hole cut for her bunions, obviously. So she's sort of quite odious in a lot of ways. But it's turned out to be very, very popular.
Well, that's interesting. My next question that I asked you this is, did everybody here read Little Women back in there?
Yes.
So I'm sure you all had a favourite little woman. Okay. So I was finding myself thinking, okay, so who's my actual favourite here? Now, I think I go for Hazel, actually, because I like her, that she's sensible, but I like that she takes risks.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't just have this. Anyway, so do you have favourites? Do you have anybody have a favourite yet?
Irene.
Yeah, we were waiting for that. Yeah.
Hazel.
Yeah. But so we're very invested in the characters.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, they've become more and more real to me. I think that Irene's become enormously popular. And one of the booksellers, a quite young woman in her 20s, was telling me Irene's her favourite. I said, do you know why? Can you articulate why? She said, I think she doesn't give a crap about anybody. She just says what she thinks. She doesn't put up with any rubbish from people. And does her own thing. Now, Irene, because she was so popular in the Tea Ladies, I have given her her own chapters from her point of view in The Cryptic Clue. And she turned out to be much more cheerful and optimistic than you might have imagined. So regardless of what is going wrong, she's always very chipper about it, which is not really what I expected. But it does make it even funnier, because something terrible happens and she thinks, oh, that's great.
I'll cope, I know.
Yeah, that's right.
Things are fine. Yeah, that's quite good. I was actually going to ask you about their names and surnames.
But you've really kind of answered that. But the one thing is, they are all Anglo, these. There is Mrs. Lee.
Yes.
So who is, and then there are unnamed Italian tea ladies. Who, yeah. I won't wreck the story, but they appear for a reason. Mm.
Well, a lot of what I know about Surrey Hills I got from the fabulous Elliot, who is an actual historian, is living my other life. And at that time, it was mainly a white area with Christian Lebanese and Italians coming in and some Chinese. In fact, Chinatown was there originally, way back when, wasn't it? Yeah. So I sort of brought that in a kind of stuffy way, because we're in difficult times right now. I couldn't write from the point of view of another nationality because it's cultural appropriation. I just wanted to bring them in gently as they might have come in at the time. Now, in the factory, I think the presses are Greek or Italian, they might be Italian, and then there's a Greek cafe they go to. So I've just sort of put it around.
Yeah. And we'll talk a bit more about the social setting, the social side, but that is incredibly important, I think, and handled really well. And do you ever give us their ages? I'm sort of thinking they're in their late 50s, early 60s. I mean, we did talk a bit about this. Is that right?
Yeah, well, in reality, tea ladies back then would have been in their 50s, which was considered pretty much ancient. I don't think we think that's ancient, do we? So I sort of made a little bit of slippage to make it more relevant today. And I imagine them being in their mid-60s. And there's a couple of references of them being in their mid-60s. So they're born around about 1900, beginning of the century. It's funny because when I first started writing, they were sort of my age or a bit older, but now I'm getting older.
They get older.
They age faster.
Well, they can age with you, like Harry Potter,
right? Age in real time.
It's a very, they're very unsexist books. That seems like a sort of funny way around to say it, but there is no doubt that these women are the heroines of the book. They're the important people.
Well, there is a secret little feminist thread that's running through them, I'm prepared to admit. And it's interesting, you know, because having been there back in the day, and a lot of you will remember this, and I brought this into The Cryptic Clue, and young women do not know this now, but in the early 70s, when some outrageous women decided they'd like to be called Ms. and not be defined by whether they were single or married, people completely lost their minds. And, you know, you couldn't go in somewhere, you couldn't go into a bank and say you were Ms. Handsome. They would absolutely refuse to write it down. It was debated, it was like wearing safety belts. People debated it endlessly. And I remember thinking, oh wow, I'd forgotten that even happened. So I brought that into the cryptic clue where Pixie's always called, so she's the young woman who works in the
name her too.
Yeah. Always called sweetheart or darling by the salesman. She says, would you mind calling me either Pixie or Ms. Carp? He's like, so, yeah, it's fun to remember those little things that I absolutely know readers will recognise. So, yes, I made them work in the garment industry because that's what Surrey Hills was. They meet every lunchtime.
They work in different factories.
Yeah, they work in different factories. Empire Fashionwear, Silhouette Knitwear.
Great title, isn't it?
Yes. I'm very interested in fashion. And, of course, in 1965, there was this fantastic, amazing, catastrophic fashion event at the Melbourne Races when Jean Shrimpton wore a dress like 4 inches above her knee.
And that's really important in here.
Yeah. Because again, it brings conflict into the story. So I thought, what would have happened in the fashion industry? That, because at that time, we were still wearing dresses that sort of had a bodice and a little belt and full skirt. And then suddenly, women went, no, we want that.
Horses.
And the fashion industry was run by men. So that is really at the heart of that, of the fashion industry being turned upside down. And people like Proactin in Australia, who then came in, she was only 21 when she started having, selling her fashion overseas, these mini dresses. So yeah, I found that was really interesting thing to bring into it as well.
I mean, the whole, as I said, the whole social history of the period is completely integral to the book. And I actually think that's one of the great things about crime fiction, that it's always set, that the period in which it is set is incredibly important. You read something written, actually written 30 years ago, and they don't have mobile phones, of course, but you just recognise it or don't recognise that time.
Yes,
it's so completely different.
Yeah.
But how about the research? I mean, one thing I found fascinating is the book opens with Hazel and Betty on holiday in Manly. Now, I remember my husband telling me that Manly was a place where people might go on holiday, but it never really occurred to me that they did. So tell me a bit about the research.
Well, Manly has boarding houses, and boarding houses were huge back then, and particularly in Surrey Hills, you know, the houses where people would rent a room, and there might be a common kitchen, or they might just have a little gas ring in their room. So I thought, well, if Hazel and Betty went on holiday, they might go up the coast, but more likely it would still be as exotic to just go on the ferry across the harbour. Because back then, people didn't travel very far. I mean, now, my kids have been all over Europe when they're 10 years old. We used to go camping in some terrible remote place in the rain. Just then, people did not go on exciting holidays. Mainly would be as exciting as it got.
Yeah. And the boarding house is really well described.
Yeah. Mm.
And the people who ran them,
yeah.
The food you got. Having to hire, to put a deposit for a deck chair.
For an
umbrella. I thought that was really interesting. There are also lots of other social elements that you reflect in the book. And one of the ones which I found as a non, I've been living in Australia for 30 years, but it struck me when I moved here, was religion. And the Catholic-Protestant divide, which comes up in a subtle way here.
Well, I guess I was just trying to depict how it is and was in society. So I imagined this St. Vincent's Church in Surrey Hills, and I imagined there being a lot of Catholics that still went to church back then. And then I imagined the people that were peripheral to those Catholics as seeing them as a little bit different. So my mother's family were all completely mad Irish Catholics that married more Irish Catholics. And she can remember being abused as a child and by the Protestant kids, and my father's Protestant, so they got married and gave the whole thing up. I guess it just is naturally, particularly in the 60s, it's naturally going to be a part of life, religion.
Yeah, and it's very much so. I mean, I think one of the things you get really well is, we won't get into the details, but there's clearly something dodgy going on in the convent, around the convent.
Yeah.
And none of the Catholic people will even look at it, because they say, well, they're the priests.
Yeah.
You know, you can't, you know, it's Father X, you can't do it. Which actually, when you think about what we've been discovering about what priests have been doing, is you kind of just touch on that. And that's, I think, one of the amazing things about these books, is that things are touched on. They're not bad. You're not going to get banged on the head with a hammer for a point. You just think, oh, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, because I really want the reader to just wander through that environment and get this sense of nostalgia. I'm not trying to paint it as a golden time, but certainly some of the more grim things that happened in the 60s, because there's enough grim things happening now. And to just kind of observe, to see this, and for it to trigger a memory for you, because you've got very different, you're informed by completely different things from me. So I can just go, oh, you know, this is here. And you go, oh, I remember, we used to have a shop in the corner like that. Yes. So I feel as though the reader can be relied on to bring a lot more to the story just through your own memories.
I mean, the casual racism is really interesting.
Yeah.
It's just there. It's not, everybody who's Anglo is dodgy.
Mm.
I mean, the Italians are pretty dubious.
And look, it's a really difficult one to handle. I sort of allude to the fact that Merle, there's a Tea Ladies Guild that's been formed, that Merle wrecked the previous Tea Ladies Guild because she wouldn't allow Mrs. Lee to join. So, you know, back then, racial slurs...
V-L-I, so Mrs. Lee is Chinese.
Back then, racial slurs were absolutely normal. Well, I don't want to use those racial slurs in my books. So I don't use them. I've just find another way to kind of get around that and see that people were marginalised without banging in.
You make it entirely clear. I mean, there are also, from memory, no Indigenous people in this book.
No.
Or in the other book. Which, again, reflects,
yes,
in their world. I mean, obviously there were, I'm not saying there were, but for the people who would have lived those lives. I mean, one thing I find very funny is the Tea Ladies Guild meets in Chinatown. In Mrs. Lee's...
In a herb shop. Yeah.
And they are, like, freaked out by the smell, because it's so, so far from what they've experienced.
Mm.
And I thought that was...
Well, I love the... I was... used to go to a Chinese herbalist and used these herbs for years, and I used to love going into the herb shops. That if you've ever been in them, you know, they have hundreds and hundreds of jars of herbs. It is like stepping into another country. I always think it would be interesting to take the Tea Ladies into something, a place that they would never have gone before. I mean, for example, they could have gone to the markets a lot when the markets were down here in Haymarket. But to go into Chinatown, that just would not have been something they'd do. So taking them places that I can also take the reader that are a little bit different.
Yeah, sort of one step further. I mean, the other thing that happens in the Crypt of Clues, this is a time when the Opera House is being built.
Yes.
I won't say much more about that, but it's sort of there in the background of everybody's lives, really.
Yes, and I just read a whole book about the Opera House called The House, which is absolutely fascinating. And, you know, the Opera House, one of the reasons I brought it in is one of the elements of the Cryptic Clues, because Hazel gets involved in things to do with the Opera House.
I'm saying we won't, we'll say no more.
Is that it was incredibly controversial. 1966 is the year that Jorn Ertzen said, that's undone, I'm leaving. And so it was in the papers all the time. And it was interesting to go into why it was controversial. When we look at it now and go, this is one of the most beautiful buildings in the world, people did not think so then. Firstly, the word opera offended like 3/4 of the population, because it was a silver tail thing for rich people. And, you know, there was a lot of press and radio about this. Oh, it's for people to tosses that are up themselves and all this kind of stuff. And so there was no sense that we would be able to go to anything in the Opera House. So the government was like, we're going to just have tenders, we'll take the cheapest thing. And Jorn Ertsen was importing those tiles that you see on there from Sweden. And there's two types of tiles. One's matte and one's shiny. And there's beautiful patterns. I mean, it is a work of art. And suddenly you've got a work of art against a government who's not interested in art. So I found that whole history of that just quite fascinating, which I bring into the book.
And also, in a sense, maybe the racism was there as well. You know, it's foreign.
Yes,
a foreigner is building our opera, bang on town opera house, but to have a foreigner building it. Like, the worst of all possible worlds. Let's look at some of the other aspects of social history. A cafe bar.
Yes.
It is essential in their lives. We know that there are no tea ladies anymore, and the cafe bar was on a step to that.
Mm.
Tell us about it.
Well, back in the 60s, people were even talking then, we're talking now about AI taking over things, but back in the day, people were talking about robots taking over, which they did in factories, in a lot of manufacturing. But, of course, the cafe bar then in the late 60s started to come in. I'm sure you've all worked in places that had the horrible cafe bar. And so I did quite a bit of research into that as well, the research side. And the cafe bar was created, the whole advertising platform was, you no longer need to deal with the grumpy tea lady, there won't be any mess, and you do not have to have tea breaks. So it was really a way that employers could eliminate tea breaks. Your staff can help themselves anytime they like. Now the reason...
Or was it free?
Usually, yes. Okay. But the cost to the firm was $1.37 a week to hire a cafe bar. And the reason the tea tasted so horrible is it was powdered tea, powdered coffee. And so, so I could see, okay, the robot is encroaching now. And for women of that age at that time, there would not have been any other work. And a lot of those women would have been war widows. So again, I could see, okay, this is a fantastic catalyst to see what the tea ladies can do to fight back, fight against the machine, so to speak.
And we won't give anything away, but it may be that in other books, that some of the tea ladies might need to get other jobs, and it'll be interesting to see what they manage to do, where they manage to go. Now, we've talked a bit about that Jean Shrimpton effect and the change in fashion, but that continues to be a big thing here. Can you say a bit about that? There's a change in management to some degree.
Well, I think that time, the Jean Shrimpton catalyst happened here in Australia. I mean, Mary Quant was always already quite established in London, and it was much more progressive. But Australia and New Zealand, I mean, I grew up in New Zealand, that was, a fair bit behind. So what happened then is that women became much more involved. Mary Quant's designs were, she said, I want to design a dress that women can run for the bus in. So suddenly we had a design that was very female-centric and comfortable. And so women wanted that design, and it was women designing them for other women. So I think that upset the whole management apple cart, so to speak, in terms of quite young women, as I said, 20s, in their 20s, were getting in and designing these frocks. And of course, the other thing, I mean, most of us could sew back in the day. So I know how much easier it was to sew one of those shifts than a dress with a bodice and darts and gathering. And I mean, I don't know about you, but if I was going out on a Saturday night, I'd run a dress up in the afternoon. Probably have to staple it around the bottom because I didn't have time to take the hem up. And when I was going out, my father would say, you are not going out there. I can see your panties. I can see the crutch of your panties, he used to say specifically. Because if you remember back in the day, we didn't have nylon panties. We had cotton panties with elastic around the waist, and the crutch did actually hang down. So panty Codes also were created at exactly the same time for the same reason. Because before that, even in our school uniforms, we wore a suspender belt and those horrible grey Lyle type stockings. So that wasn't going to work with the miniskirt. So suddenly we had the development of pantyhose. So, yes,
in England, in the late 60s, early 70s, which is past it, we certainly didn't wear those. We wore tights, they called them.
Yeah, tights. So they were in England, I think, early 60s, and then came here a bit later on.
Or you wear them less here anyway, because it's warmer, you'd like to think.
But a lot of officers back then didn't allow women to come to work with bare legs or with trousers.
Oh, yeah, you do mention trousers in your book. Yeah. Mm. Oh, my goodness. So in Empire fashion wear, whatever it's called, you end up with kind of two factories almost, two organisations, the sort of old-fashioned one, all the traditional clothing, and then Pixie with her
working within that.
Yes, that's right. And somebody comes in to say, well, we want to give more emphasis to the traditional fashion wear.
Mm.
And it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next book.
And I think it's sort of representative of any industry that there will be some people that go, no, this is a fad, we stick with what we're doing, people will come back to negligee, da-da-da-da, we're just going to go hard on this thing that actually people have lost interest in. And I think it's partly because they can't understand the new. Why would women want to wear these little shifts? So, that's what a man would think. They're so unattractive and they're like old sacks or whatever. So, yeah, you're always going to have that division in any company.
And the person who comes in wants to have basically wants to have a whole kind of outfit for your evening, we won't go into too much of the details. There is a wonderful line, somebody described as having a hemline closer to the hip than the knee, which is really good. Now, men's fashions must have been changing as well. You don't talk about them.
No, I think the mid to late 60s, though, men did start to wear much brighter colours. They wore the paisley shirts, do you remember that, the wide ties. And then the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's album brought on the whole thing of sort of military, faux military uniform stuff. It wasn't all men. A lot of men were still wearing, let's not forget, the walk shorts with the long socks. Don't ask. They're like a suit short. They're like a jort for suits. Jean shorts. And it was like suit pants that came down to the knee, and then you wore long walk socks up to here. And that was very popular in the 70s. A lot of men wore that. So I think men are not so adventurous in fashion, is my estimation of it.
Yeah, and I mean, with women it was so noticeable.
Yeah,
yeah. The books, I should say, are full of humour, and that's a really refreshing. It was just very refreshing. Can you read a bit?
Oh yes, I was going to read a little bit here.
This is Irene, who's your favourite, we gather.
Yeah. So in our second chapter in Cryptic Clue, the first chapter is Hazel and Betty on holiday in Manly. But Irene is now living with Hazel, and she spent the whole week trying to find the good whiskey. And then she's, obviously been eating out of cans and just living her terrible life. And then she suddenly realises Hazel's on the way back. As Irene walks in the front door of 5 Glade Street, it dawns on her that Hazel's coming back this evening. She glances around, trying to see the place through Hazel's eyes. Not bad, could do better. She tops up the bottle of whiskey from the tap, tucks it back into its hiding place in the broom cupboard. In the kitchen, she scrapes the breadcrumbs and apple peelings off the bench and throws them into the backyard for the birds. She rakes up the crumbs on the floor with her foot, lifts the corner of the mat, pushes them under. The toaster is a problem. She flips the door down and stares at the blackened crumpet glued to the element. It was a mistake to put butter and jam on first. Now it looks like a small fried bat hanging off a power line, not something you'd eat unless you had to. She gets out a knife and pokes it between the element and the bat. When she comes round, she's slumped against the Krypton cupboards with dentures in her lap and a splitting headache, thinking she's been struck by lightning. Her hat feels hot, and the smell of burnt hair hangs in the air. She tries to take the hat off, but the bloody thing's melted onto her head. Without ripping all her hair out, the hat's going nowhere. She puts her clackers in her pocket, flops over onto her knees, and crawls down the hall to the broom cupboard. If there was ever a time when she needed a drink, this is it. Still seeing double, maybe even triple, she reaches into the cupboard and grabs the whiskey bottle. There seem to be a few in there now, by the neck. Sitting in the hall, she leans against the wall and takes a good sweep and closes her eyes. She opens them again to blinding brightness. The hallway is filled with golden light. A host of angels hover over her. She must be at the gates of heaven. Her time has come. Relieved she's not in the burning fires of hell, she gives herself up to the afterlife, murmuring a prayer under her breath to remind him of her devotion. Better late than never. It feels good, even with a raging headache. The angels gaze down on her with worried frowns. She never expected a welcome committee this size. A confusing number of hands reach towards her, and a familiar voice says, "You look in need of a strong cup of tea, Irene dear. Let me help you up." So that's Hazel.
That's the tone, really. It's a light tone, but there's an awful lot underneath the surface. I forgot to mention the dentures and the hats, because that's really important.
Yes.
Well, a lot of women back then used to wear a hat. You know, in Coronation Street, they always wore just a hat, just a sort of a, not a cloche, I don't know what sort of hat it was. I actually used to call it a pot-lid hat. And I worked with a guy who'd had dentures. Dentures didn't used to fit very well then. And he used to often have his dentures just drop unexpectedly. The top would just suddenly drop down or clack down. And I think they were also uncomfortable. So people with dentures, I don't know if they can remember this, they'd sort of push them out a bit. Or if they were eating something with, you know, let's say seed cake or lamingtons, they'd take them out because, you know, you can gum a lamington to death. And so I thought it would be fun for Irene. And of course, a lot of people had all their teeth taken out.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, older people had been told it's much cheaper to have all your teeth removed and just have these horrible clackers.
Yes.
Well, I've got lots more questions, but let's see if you've got any. Is there a mic or?
Hi, thank you. That's really interesting. I'm just wondering, we were talking about the social side of things. When you're writing the book, how hard is it, or how many drafts does it take you to take out current day sort of information or prejudices from now to better reflect then?
Look, I don't want to sound too arty-farty, but really when I'm writing, it's like I'm seeing a movie in front of me. So I'm not seeing current day, I'm just seeing the 60s. I'm seeing the streets I've walked over and over again in Surrey Hills. I'm seeing where things are in relation to each other. I'm seeing phone boxes. One of the things that appealed to me in terms of the crime side is information moved very slowly then. It was either a letter, telegram, word of mouth, or telephone. And a lot of people didn't have telephones. So I'm only seeing those things. It's just nothing. That's all I'm seeing.
Just two quick questions. One is, you said some books were very popular. You know, this is prior to the Tea Ladies ones. Mm-hmm. Some were popular and some not so much. I'd like to know really which ones were and which ones weren't. And the second question I had, you did say that you didn't really want to write from the point of view of a different culture. And so I'd like you to elaborate on that.
Well, I think, let me do the second one first, just to bamboozle everyone. I think that I am kind of uniquely qualified
to write about the subject and this time and about older women. I mean, I'm 70, so I'm looking at exactly what it's like to be a woman of this age. So if I were to put myself in the shoes of a 30-year-old, I just couldn't hope to really deliver that onto the page with any sort of authenticity. And sometimes when I read in books about older women, you just don't get it at all. You're seeing us like we were always old, but we weren't. And so I think to write in a really authentic way, it's helpful to be as close to your real life experience as you can be. Look, I think that I get very, very interested in, this is on the first question now, I get very interested in things that other people are not that interested in. It's hard for me to tell the difference. And so my first book, The Olive Sisters, was hugely popular. And that was about a woman losing her corporate empire and inheriting this olive grove in country New South Wales, discovering her Italian heritage and secrets in her family. Now, to me, what makes a book popular is simply zeitgeist. At that time, people were interested in Italy, books about Italy, everything to do with Italy, and although this wasn't in Italy, it had those kind of themes and just went gangbusters. So then I had an idea, which was a sort of woman against the world, and I wrote a book called Two for the Road. It's about a woman who is forced to take over her father's tow truck company in a seaside town in New South Wales. And so it's secrets from the past and trying to work in a really, really criminal. I mean, tow truck drivers are generally in the criminal world rather than the... It's an interesting... It's true. It's an interesting intersect between the criminal world and the legitimate world. And so you might have sat in a cab with a tow truck driver. You probably had a mullet down to here, but they are really dodgy. I rode around with tow truck drivers in my research, so you can take it from me. Not something I would recommend. So that obviously did not capture the public imagination. And then The Olive Sisters was going to be made into a movie, and I got involved with that, and I worked with the producers and wrote a script, and then I wrote a few other different scripts at that time, and then that went on and on and on, and then I could write a whole book about that. They were American, and in the end I decided, okay, I'm going to draw a line under the bat, and I stopped renewing the option, and we all went on with our lives. So then I thought, well, I'm just going to write an absolute crowd pleaser, and wrote The French Perfumer, which is set in the 60s, about a young, young secretary who leaves London and goes and works as a secretary in the south of France for a perfumer. And again, there's sort of secrets and deceptions going on there. So that was very popular. Then I wrote another one called The Yellow Villa, also set in France, a bit less popular. 60 Summers, about three friends turning 60 who decide to, you've read that one, have you?
Right.
Yeah, oh, okay, good. Decide to retrace the steps of their 1978 backpacking trip through Europe, and they're now 60, so you know, what could possibly go wrong? And so it's quite popular, and Lovebirds got smashed in lockdown. And so then I thought, okay, we'll regroup, do something completely different. And the Tea Ladies, I can tell you something. If you publish a book that's not going well, you will hear nothing but a deathly silence from the publisher. Nothing. You go, okay, better get on with the next one. But the Tea Ladies, I was getting daily, he was, oh, it's selling mad, we can't keep up the reprints. So it's now sold, I think around 30,000 in the last year, which
that's
is massive in Australia. Yeah. Most books sell 3, 5, 5
is a like big print run.
Yeah.
A lot for Chris Hammer, possibly. But
So I just think it's again zeitgeist. It's come at a time. This is the second golden age of crime, particularly crazy crime.
I think people love the nostalgia, the escape from the current world, and having a bit of a laugh.
But they also like the lack of violence, I think. I mean, the name, the hippopotamus in the room is Richard Osman in a way, because that's cozy crime, but it's not in the past.
No, I mean, if anybody's wondering what defines cosy crime, I mean, you can have murders, but you don't have anything explicit. It's like everything takes place off stage. And I mean, a lot of people don't like the phrase, I love it, I love being cosy.
Yeah, I know, it isn't knitting. I mean, it necessarily can be
stabbed someone with
a knitting or whatever,
Or
there is the most extraordinary range of cosy crime. I mean, there's a whole series of books called about cheese, for example, you know, camembert, capers, or anything like that. But I think what's interesting is that it can explore, it can be real life, with something nasty happening in the woodshed. So.
Well, because that becomes the spine of the story.
Mm.
You know, I have one overarching spine that just makes it a page turner, that is, this is the crime. But in the meantime, there's all sorts of other things going on. I mean, my personal taste in reading is much more literary. I mean, Barbara Kingsolver, I absolutely idolise, Anne Patchett.
The Demon Copperhead, yeah.
Oh,
we'd love to recommend that.
Yeah,
hard to read, a long book, but incredible. Just glimpse into America in the
2010?
Oh, 90s. Completely extraordinary, but anyway. Now, you talked about film. So, where is the television series?
Oh, I wish. We were just talking about this earlier.
Yeah.
And how cool, those people have read the tea leaves, how cool would it be to see that all that fashion and 60s and... So, that's out of my power. It's funny because, basically, the author writes the book and then works on getting the book to the best state. So, you know, I have a say in the cover, and, you know, I actually pick the garment. I send the garment reference. I've already sent the garment reference for the next book. Because I was there, I know what was, you know, the designers probably 40. So people will tell me that the book's not in particular shops. I'm not in charge of distribution. I am just the author.
But if that happens, if you can't find the book in the shop, what I would recommend is just say to the bookseller, I'm looking for this book. It's just the best book ever.
Yeah.
Surely you need to have film. That's what you
don't need to send me a message on social media.
She can't control it.
Yeah. And so television series, that is something that, you know,
is that what your agent
would be? Need to do that. So your agent needs to do that. And yeah, I just get on with the next book and put my work into that.
Yeah, many people don't, well, why would they, know the way that publishing works, really.
Oh, I mean, I've been with Penguin for 20 years. And even, I don't 100% know the internal politics. Everything's different departments. You know, I deal with editorial, I deal with marketing. It's all women now. You know, I'll be working with somebody in one book, then they're not there the next book, and I assume they've gone to have a baby because of the next book, they'll be back again. And, it's like, sort of, imagine it's like the ATO, but with books.
They may have moved to another publisher with a slightly higher job. That keeps happening to me. I email somebody and I get, I am no longer at this. But you are. You still work in publishing because she's moved from Ashet to Penguin.
That's right.
Penguin to
whatever. But I would never leave Penguin because of all these ups and downs with books, never ever has the enthusiasm of my same editor that I've worked with all those years, Ellie Watts, ever waned. And when The Tea Ladies was coming out, we had a meeting, because I live in Melbourne, and we had a meeting there. And I said, you know, Ellie, with the, you know, dismal performance of Lovebirds, I said, if this doesn't catch fire, I think I'll pack it in because it's a waste of paper. And she went, oh, I've really got to get on this book. And, well, I didn't have to, as it turns out.
So you still have the same editor?
Yes, same
to
editor.
All of these
years, all of these years. And she is so excited. She's so proud and excited because she has been, you know, supporting me and...
This is your moment.
this is my moment.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm afraid Anna says a burning question. We're going to have to stop. But Elliot's going to tell us a bit, come up and tell us a bit about if you feel like having a walk, where we're walking.
Well, I should tell you a little bit about Elliot first, is because Elliot is really the wind beneath my wings in terms of his tours. So I first went, how long ago do you reckon that was? 3 years?
Yeah, 3 years ago.
So I signed up for a tour, walking tour. So Elliot's a historian of Surrey Hills. And it was a bit rainy that day, and all the sookies didn't turn up. And it was just me and Elliot. We had a fantastic time. We went all over Surrey Hills, and we had a nice lunch, and we talked about the tea ladies, because I was just writing it then. And so that has really informed me so much. And then a few months ago, I did a tour of Darlinghurst with Elliot, and that has come into the next book. So now I need more inspiration to go on another tour.
It's the Upper North Shore. But yeah, because I'd actually invited Elliot. I'm the director, artistic director of Bad Sydney. And if you do if you haven't already taken your bookmark, do take it and sign up to our mailing list. And you many of you already are recognised your faces. You can find out what we do. So I thought, Elliot was doing some walks, and I read the tea ladies, and I thought these two should know each other. You know, a bit late, like matchmaking, too late, isn't it?
But yeah, it worked out quite nicely.
Yeah, it was brilliant. It was a really good tour.
Which is good to know, which means that the tour we're about to do has been tried and tested already. So, folks, as I was just introduced, my name's Elliot. I'm a historian. I'm based in my office in my house up in Surrey Hills. So today, after this, at 3 o'clock, I believe it starts, we are doing a historical tour of Surrey Hills. Okay, it is obviously because it's a cozy, you could say it's a true crime, cozy crime sort of historical tour. And we're going to be exploring the Algarmon district of Surrey Hills. So we're going to be going through Old Kippack Street in these areas. It's a gentle walk, it only goes for about an hour and a half. We're going to be covering the history of the Garment district. We'll talk about, we've got some great slides and photos to show everyone as well. Some before, you know, then and now photos, I'm sure we all love those. And yeah, we're going to be talking about some of the criminal element that took place in there, as well as the commercial side of things. It's going to be very nice. It starts at the, approximately where the Chalmers Street light rail is, the exit to Central Train Station, the big old sandstone pavilion on Elizabeth Street and Faveau, and we finish at the Surrey Hills light rail stop. So it's very, very easy, very gentle. So if anyone would like to come along, there's still quite a few places left. You're welcome to either just book into one of these things here, or just come to me and we can speak to you. It's not a problem at all, okay? So thank you very much, everyone, and hopefully I can see you all join us. Otherwise, if not this time, most welcome to come in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Elliot, and thank you, Amanda, for such a fascinating talk. We can carry on to the heaven, then. Thank you.